today we're joined by our influence partner, Paul Noon from Coventry University. Paul is a doctor and an OBE, and so we're looking forward to finding out how that experience was later on in this podcast. So Paul, tell us a bit about your background. Tell us about that, all those experiences you had growing up, what school you went to, and really what brought you to where you are now.
Gosh, it feels like a long story. It's quite a while ago. So I guess I spent my sort of formative years going to primary school and secondary school in Whitby in North Yorkshire, which is a lovely place to grow up. I had a pony that I could ride. I had some great friends, and it was a nice sort of safe place to grow up. But I think a place where I learned an enormous amount about trying different things, about doing things in a different way. As I said, my mates were wonderful, and it felt like we were given quite a lot of rope to experience different things. And we used to get up to all sorts, but in a safe and appropriate way, of course. But it was a lovely childhood, being able to explore the country. We were very into music. We did all sorts of different things, went on trips, etc. And I think I learned a lot about just that sort of having a go at stuff. I think it gave me a sort of self-confidence to say, well, have a go at it, you'll be okay. And a lot of that comes back to that childhood where we used to experiment and do all sorts of different things. We used to make bombs, and we made wine, and we had a band, and I was in the theatre. I was in the National Youth Theatre. That was a great experience that took me out of what is a relatively small community, dropped me in the middle of London at 14 with people from all over the country. Really exciting. I've got very fond memories of growing up in a lovely part of the country with some wonderful people who I'm obviously still connected to now, great teachers that were just inspiring. Interestingly, a few months ago, a year or two ago, I professionally met up with one of those teachers again. And it's been lovely to work with him over the last few years in developing some really interesting things with the Premier League, with football. I had a great childhood. It set me well for my future. And I think I always had a bit of that sort of wanderlust, I enjoyed where I was, but always interested in what was going on outside. My sister stayed in the same town for her whole life. I got an opportunity to explore and to move on, and I went and did that quite early on. And I think I all of that stuff that I learned, all of those experiences that I had, have given me the tools I need to be able to go and explore the world and travel the world and do different things, and have an interesting, certainly for me, a life that's been great so far. I've really enjoyed it, but a lot of it came from that solid, safe, but exciting and exploratory and supportive childhood that I had in Whitby.
I'm still stuck on the making bombs, to be honest, Paul.
Oh.
And where your kind of future goes on to as well. I feel like that wouldn't have been in your CV when you applied for some of your future jobs.
No, it wasn't top of the list of things that I talked about when I tried to join the Foreign Office. But so we had it was a group of us, and what happened was that our form room was in the science lab, and we did make bombs, and we also used to distill pure alcohol and all sorts of different things. But it was all done, it was all about science. It wasn't about anything other than could we do it and what was the science behind it. But yeah, we did. And obviously no one ever really got hurt, and there was nothing really negative about it. But we wanted to try things out. We wanted to explore stuff, and we had the opportunity, and we took it, and it was great fun. And I used to And I wonder whether young people today still have that opportunity. I used to go out at sort of 8 o'clock in the morning, and yeah, I would turn up, you know, in the evening or a day later, I'd be staying with my mates or whatever, and my parents just were okay. It's all going to be all right, and you know, we hitchhiked down to Birmingham to watch Pink Floyd at the NEC. I'm not sure my parents knew that I was away for 2 days and sleeping by the side of a motorway and that sort of stuff. But we looked after each other, and we were safe, and we had some really interesting experiences, and I think it all helped make me who I was. But it did feel safe and like we were together and looking after each other, and you know, I'm sure we did put ourselves in a bit of danger, but it didn't really feel like that. So I thank my parents for giving me the road to do all of that sort of exploratory stuff and to enjoy myself.
So even when you were young and you were exploring, do you think that's what gave you that sort of appetite to want to explore the world when you got a bit older?
Yeah, I've always been curious. I've always been curious about different places, different people, different cultures. And certainly going around the world, one of the things I've always enjoyed doing is finding out about other people, how they operate, how they work, that sort of thing. You know, it's fascinating, and I think I try and not bring any judgment with me in those situations, because I don't think it's helpful. And understanding or getting another person's perspective, you suddenly get an insight into why they do things that might seem a little bit weird to us. But I think if you have an open mind, you can learn enormous amounts, and it's fun and it's interesting, and it's one of the joys of travelling and exploring, I think. So I'm sure that came from a childhood where I was pretty loose to go and do whatever I wanted. I enjoyed school, I enjoyed my friends, I enjoyed my community where I lived. I was in the pantomime, I did all sorts of stuff, and I've got very fond memories of that time.
And a childhood by the sea, and now you're in the middle of England as well.
Do you know what? That's really interesting. So I travelled all over the world, and I'm trying to think. I don't think. Oh, so Sydney, I was obviously by the sea, but in many places, and Wellington, but many places I wasn't. And when I used to go home, see my mum and dad and sister, one of the first things I would do is go and look at the sea. It has something important for me. I'd drive to the cliff and just look at the sea because I've missed it, you know. And so, I mean, before I sort of joined the Foreign Office, we had a small fishing boat, and I used to go salmon fishing in the summer and take fishing parties out. I was a fisherman. We had crab pots, and we used to do that in the winter. So the sea's always been important to me, and it's something I miss a lot. And so when I go home, go up the cliff, have a look at the sea, and I like it when it's raw and, you know, smashing and, you know, dark. That's when it's exciting.
So thinking about now you're in academia, thinking back to that time at school, is there anything you really excelled at?
Gosh, so I was probably good at science, computers. I was quite good at it. It was relatively early on in the time. Maths and those sorts of things I enjoyed, but I was a student that I guess I got away with quite a lot. I was one of those people that can sort of retain information and then sort of get it out in an exam. I'm not particularly hardworking, I think, but I wasn't a great student, and I always had this idea of looking for other things to do. So I did my A-levels and got to nearly the end of them, not to the end of them, but nearly to the end of them, I think about around Christmas time, and an opportunity to go and work in Scarborough came up. So I stopped doing my A-levels, I went back and took the exams, but didn't really put any effort into it, and went and started work. So Yeah, I mean, I think if I'd have had my choices again, I might have done something a bit different and put a bit more effort in and gone to university at that point, rather than later on in life when I did my first degree by correspondence. I would have probably done something a bit different at that time. But, you know, I was wanting to experience new things, so went off and did them. And, you know, no point in regretting, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely not. I think you always end up where you're meant to be, don't you? And the way that the process of life is and where you've ended up now, it's that path, it's the journey.
Yeah, I agree. And I think I've always... So I worked as a builder for a little while, and I can remember the guy I worked with used to go and people would say, can you come round to look at a job? And we'd go around and they say, you know, we want this extension building or something. We didn't have the skills to do that in the team, but we knew we could get somebody in. So the answer was always, yes, we can do that, whether we have the skills or not. That's something that's sort of kept with me, you know, an opportunity to do something, I thought, you know, I'll have a go at that. And honestly, I've built a whole career, whole life on the basis of having a go at stuff. And I usually have some tools that I can use to be successful at it, or I can bring other people in to help me do it. And I mean, that it's a piece of advice I give to my daughter a lot, that I think sometimes people look at opportunities and think, oh, well, I've got 50% of that, but I'm missing stuff, and so it's not right for me now. Actually, if you've got 50, 60% of it, that's probably enough. You don't need 100%, and people shouldn't be holding themselves back. They should push themselves, and that feeling of not being quite right, not having everything, is probably good. It means you're stretching yourself and doing things slightly outside your comfort zone. I think that's how you grow. And I think those are some of the things I learned from working as a builder and working in a bar and being a fisherman, that sort of thing, that, you know, have a go at it. You don't have to have everything. You don't have to be an expert to have to do something. You just have to have a bit of energy, some tools, some hard work, and the ability to bring some expertise in when you need it. But you don't necessarily have to have the whole portfolio before you start a task.
That's a really entrepreneurial message. Think about those businesses that are listening to this call that actually have taken that leap in their own lives, and they're probably listening to that and thinking, God, I did the same thing. I had the idea this is something I wanted to do and took that leap.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you're quite entrepreneurial?
I think I am, and I try to be, and I think that's part of what I try to do, trying to find new ways of doing things, new opportunities and exploring different things. I get, one of the joys of my current role is I get to work with entrepreneurs a lot. You know, we generate lots of spin-out companies in the university, and I sit on the board of some of our spin-out companies, and seeing them sort of taking that chance. We haven't got all the answers, but we've got an idea. I think we underestimate the value of entrepreneurs that have got that inner ability to have a go at something and try, and the effort that they put in, the care that they put into their jobs. And sometimes it doesn't work and you have to shift and change, but they just keep going. It's something I really admire in my colleagues. I think, I was a civil servant for a very long time, which you wouldn't necessarily think as being a particularly entrepreneurial place to be. I've always tried to find different ways of doing things, to change what we're doing in my career. And it's probably one of the things that's helped me. You know, I'm not a traditional diplomat. I probably wasn't even a very good diplomat. But I was able to sort of carve a career that was successful and certainly was fulfilling for me, based on change and driving things forward, bringing teams together, doing things in a different way, challenging stuff, trying to achieve an outcome that wasn't even considered possible. I think if you have that sort of attitude, you can do some amazing things, and we do absolutely see that in our entrepreneurs, no doubt.
the one strong message that's coming through there is that transferable skills. You've done a lot of different careers, but you've carried them skills forward. And that's something that entrepreneurs and business people need to be doing all the time, is taking their skills onto their new opportunities, because that is so important, isn't it? When an opportunity comes, you need to just try and get out there and do it. So thinking on that sort of early career, what were those roles? Which ones really stand out for you, where you think you picked up the most skills, you think you really stood out?
It's a good question, Sean. I think, honestly, I've enjoyed every role I've had, even when I've gone into a role and thought, this is rubbish, you know, I don't want to do this. There's been a few of those. One in particular stands out. When I got there, I thought, God, this is going to bore me to death if I'm doing this for the next 3 years. And what I basically did was got rid of the role. I did myself out of the job. I delegated all my responsibilities down to the people actually doing the work. And so I left myself with no role, which allowed me to go and do something that was really interesting. So I got rid of my job to do something that was more interesting. And even just learning about that empowerment of other people and saying, you know, you don't need me to manage you to do that. You just take it on. It's your responsibility now. I'll go and do something that interests me in particular. And so every role, I pick something up. I've had people that have helped me. I've worked with people. I've had things that have inspired me. And so even at the most difficult times, and there has been really difficult times, there's been something in it that I've been able to draw from and just build into my, you know, my toolbox of tools that I can bring out when something else happens. And you know, we talk about my early career and what I was doing, but you know, today, you know, I talk to my colleagues. They've got a different perspective. I learn from them. It's one of the thrills of working in a university. So all the way through, I think drawing that inspiration and knowledge from lots of other people has served me well, and has given me some tools that I can use to sort of, you know, approach the challenges that are ahead of me.
So you talk about those kind of different, like looking at things differently and changing and all of that. Where do you think that motivation comes from? Because it sounds like it just comes naturally to you, but then it's also, there must be something that you like strive for, knowledge or understanding. Like, where's that from?
Gosh, it's a good question. I've always been curious. I think, you know, some of those things I was talking about in my childhood were about curiosity. But I think it's self-fulfilling. When you learn something new, and it gives you some insight that you didn't have, you want to do more of that. And so you get to a stage where that becomes the object of your life, to find new ways of doing things, to try things out. And I guess as you get more senior, what you do then is try and encourage your teams, the teams around you, to be challenging, to look for new ideas. And so I think it comes from a curiosity as a child, but I think it's been reinforced all the way through my career because it's been successful for me. It's given me an edge. It's given me a way forward. It's given me a way of doing things that I enjoy and find, inspiring or whatever. I think it's reinforced itself because it's been successful. And I enjoy it as well. You know, there's nothing nicer than finding out something new, being inspired by somebody that you didn't know before. And I find that a lot. And, I guess we'll talk a bit later, but, it's one of the reasons why being part of the Chamber is great. You know, you meet people from completely different roles, from different jobs, different industries, and they're great at what they do, and that's it really interesting to me. What can I learn from that, and what can I apply to the challenges that are sat around me? So, yeah, always been inspired by other people, their experiences, and that sort of curiosity has sort of taken me through. It's curiosity is a great skill for a diplomat to have, finding out what's going on with another country, what's driving them, what's pushing their policy decisions, what do they think about the UK, you know, what's positive, what's negative. That curiosity is a really important skill to have, but I think it's important in every walk of life, and certainly something I encourage the people around me to have.
Hi, I'm Lee from City Fibre. I'm the Regional Partnership Director for the Midlands. We build full fibre networks and we've covered about 70% of Coventry so far, with the main build was due to finish in 2023, is likely to finish round about the middle of 2022. It's a great job, great area to be working in, and we really value our chamber membership because we get to meet lots of fascinating people, we get introductions where we need them, and also we get to come to some fabulous events. I strongly recommend it.
So Paul, you talked about that career in the civil service, you talked about working in the Foreign Office. How long did you work there for? What really did you take out of it? And are there any sort of overarching memories you've got from that experience?
Oh, many, many. So I was there for 28 years. So I joined the Foreign Office a bit by mistake. I was in a job centre, it was on the wall. I thought, oh, I could do that. And applied, didn't know what I was doing. I thought I'd be issuing passports. In London, that's what I thought my job would be. And then in that first week of induction, it said, you know, you'll do some jobs in London and then you'll go overseas. And I remember thinking, what? Overseas? Me? Where? Well, anywhere, you know. So it wasn't a great plan of mine. It was something I sort of fell into a bit by accident. I had a wonderful career. I have no regrets at all about my time. My first job overseas was in Damascus, and I remember I had no idea where it was, I had no idea what was going on there. It was in the first Gulf War. You might not even remember that. It was in the first Gulf War when I found out I was going. I could find out nothing about Syria. I was in the emergency unit for the first Gulf War, so you know, I had to work all night. And me and a colleague would be there moving papers around, keeping people informed. He got his posting the same day as I got mine. I was going to Damascus, and all I could really find was a sort of human rights report about Syria. And he was going to Mauritius. And so over the next few days, he sort of side of the desk sort of piled up with brochures with lobsters and beaches on it, and you know, palm trees. And I had a human rights report. So I wasn't particularly well prepared to go to Damascus, but it was exciting and interesting. And the big thing that happened there were that the hostages were released. So we had three hostages in Lebanon, John McCarthy, Jackie Mann and Terry Waite. And I, about 6 months after I got there, John McCarthy was released. And we were the centre of the world in terms of the media at that time. I remember I sending telegrams back to the UK, and I'd walk back into my office and there'd be a news flash on the World Service and they'd be reading out what I'd just written. It was so exciting, and I spoke to John after he'd been released. I informed his family that he'd been released. You know, it was just so exciting. And you know, a bit like I've spoken about before, we explored the country, which is amazing, with castles and deserts and people that are warm and friendly and welcoming. So Syria was a wonderful first posting. I then went to Bonn, where we were moving our embassy from Bonn to Berlin. But I enjoyed Germany. My grandmother's German, so I've got some family there as well. So that was lovely. And then back to the UK, and then I think the posting that probably was the most important for me in terms of my career, my children were at the right age, I got sent to Wellington in New Zealand. And New Zealand is a sort of small version of the UK, and policy that happens in New Zealand is often applicable to policy in the UK. So I had this remit to go and find new things that New Zealand was doing and relating them back to the UK. So it was really exciting, and I worked with some wonderful colleagues there, and I think really the thing I took out of that most, that if you can get that great team around you, I mean really special people around you, you can achieve magic. You can do incredible things that you never thought were possible. And in New Zealand, the team I had there was that team, and we did some amazing things. We ran an enormous conference on climate change that Tony Blair came, and it was something that shifted policy in New Zealand. Climate change is a big issue for a country like New Zealand, where actually most of the emissions come from sheep and cows, so it's difficult to get right. So I love New Zealand, and left a big piece of myself there, no doubt, lots of friends, lots of memories, etc. And having had such a wonderful time in New Zealand, I was then sent to the Congo, to Kinshasa, which is, so Wellington is probably the least best place in the world to prepare yourself to go to Kinshasa, which was mired by war and poverty and was difficult. And I was the deputy ambassador in Kinshasa at a time when there was lots of fighting, and I found myself in some big scrapes, you know, being shot at by tanks, having to hide in a basement with a cannibal, you know. And absolutely tested to my limit, you know, having to make life and death decisions, having to deal with people at their most stressed and most difficult, having to look after lots of people. And a lot of these events happened when I was in charge. So, you know, I was thrust into having to make these really difficult decisions and having to keep people safe and keep people focused, etc. So, you know, a very different experience to Wellington, a very different experience to anything else I've had, but absolutely pushed me to my edge. And I remember feeling several times completely full. So my son couldn't get back from school. He was living in a basement in school because of fighting. And I remember having to put a note on my door that Alex was at school and stuck, because I couldn't hold that in my head. I had too much else going on. I knew that I had to, when I left my office, I had to ask about him. Was he okay? So I had to leave a message for myself to do that, because there was just no space. I've never experienced that fullness before, but it happened many times when I was in Kinshasa. So, you know, it was traumatic, it was tough. I found it personally very tough, and it took me quite a long time to get over it. And I think that sort of mental health stuff, absolutely very, very real. And then I went to Australia, and when I came back from Australia, and I had a lovely time in Sydney and didn't get shot at at all, which I think was positive. And then came back, and my last job in the Foreign Office was as regional director for UKTI in the West Midlands, and that's what brought me out of London up to Birmingham, and then in the end led to me going to Coventry. So I had a wonderful career. I don't regret any of it. It was challenging, it was fun, interesting. You know, I've got lots of stories about doing things that I think, having experiences that people just never get that opportunity to have. So I don't regret it at all. I'm happy where I am now, and I would encourage anybody who wants to join the Foreign Office to go for it, because it's wonderful. But yeah, I had a great career.
I've got so many follow-up questions to that. I don't even know where to start. I think I'm going to start in Congo, because that was very, seems like a difficult part of your life. But when you said that you were so full, you said that you wrote down that note, but how did you compartmentalize and focus on your aims of the job? but then also you've got a team that you're trying to keep safe, which is obviously a priority. So how did you kind of work through that?
And a family.
And
as
a family,
well,
yeah.
That were, and people whose family weren't safe, you know, who were begging or asking, certainly, with real passion for their family to be rescued. And, you know, the balancing of these decisions was very difficult. So I got some really good advice from the defence attaché. And this was before all of this happened, but he said, you'll have to make some decisions that are difficult, that are really challenging, and people will want immediate responses. And he said to me, just take a breath, think about it. You don't have to make a decision immediately. Take a breath, think about it, come to a decision, and then people will follow you. And I think doing that is, that's exactly what I did. I just took a bit of time, thought about it, took some advice, made a decision, and then went on. I think that gives an air of calmness, an air. You might be absolutely churning up inside, but it gives you an air of calmness, and then people will follow you, and you can bring people along. And it meant that I did have lots to think about. We had, 150 people on the compound that we were keeping safe, including journalists and staff and their families and all sorts of things. We had, a requirement, we were potentially going to have to evacuate people, a requirement from the Foreign Office on what was going on. I'd, my own family issues that I was having to deal with. My son wasn't with us, and you know, we didn't know he was safe and all that sort of stuff. So I think I had a great team, and they just, nobody, everyone just buckled down and got on and did something. And whether they were policy officers that were doing the food and making sure everyone was fed properly, whether there was, we absolutely had a journalist that was sat outside the toilets making sure people washed their hands, because we knew that if we didn't manage cleanliness, within 3 or 4 days we would have cholera on the compound. So we were, assiduous in making sure. In fact, the compound had never been as clean, because one of the things I really learned was people need stuff to do. The worst thing you can do is boredom. And when people get bored, they start, oh, I need to go home, I need to do this, I need to get out. So keeping people busy was really important. So we gave everybody a job. You know, I used to go and brief them every 4 hours. And there was rockets and stuff going above us, and people being shot outside in the street. Give them jobs, keep them going. We had people digging holes at one stage. We had, potentially for bodies, but we didn't never had to put a body in them, but it also kept them busy. Those were the sort of things we had to do. And as I say, I had a team of people who were brave and supportive, never questioned me. Well, certainly did question me, but never were not supportive when it was required. And we got through it. And, as I say, it was horrible at the time, and it was frightening and scary, and I was certainly terrified. But also something I wouldn't have not, I wouldn't want to have not experienced that now, because it was so, I learnt an enormous amount, and I was very proud of how we all dealt with it all. And as I said, I think it did have an impact that took quite a while to go.
It just sounds so different to where we are now, and I bet you formed those relationships that's something that no one else can understand apart from those people that are in that room with you.
Yeah, and it's interesting that so the people that were there, so there was a group of people, we had quite a big embassy, we had a group of people that were there and experienced it, and a group of people that weren't there and didn't experience it. And actually, one of the challenges was when that group, then those groups came back together, because they didn't. It was difficult to explain what had happened. We had this group of people with this shared experience of terror at times, and those people that didn't quite understand. They, you know, they obviously knew the context and everything, but they hadn't quite been through it. And that was quite difficult, and certainly created some friction, and because their response to what had happened was different depending on which group you came from. So yeah, it was that was one of the difficult things we had to navigate after these crises. And there was three or four of them. It wasn't a one-off. It happened several times.
It's clearly a life-changing experience. It clearly is. Like, I was genuinely in shock. I'm a bit concerned that this is being recorded because my mouth was open pretty much the whole time then. But what made you, so having experienced all that, having brought through a team, having done it all and led people through that, what then brought around that decision to hang it up and leave?
It's a good question, and I guess it's about this sort of curiosity again. And so I did my job in Birmingham. I loved it. I worked right across the West Midlands, and I used to love going and meeting companies, and I guess you get this from your work in the chamber, and it was inspiring. I enjoyed it, and I got to the end of that, and usually that's the, and I was ready to go abroad again. And I guess I was mid-40s, and it was like, well, if I go abroad again, go through another cycle, that's another 10 years, I'll be mid-50s. So basically, if I go abroad now, I'm going to retire from the Foreign Office, which wasn't a bad opportunity for me. I'd have been an ambassador, probably, which would have been great fun. But I thought, why not have a look and see if I can do something else? So and it wasn't like I've got to get another job and I've got to, and I can't go off and do another set of postings in the Foreign Office, but I thought I'll have a look. And I applied for a couple of jobs in Birmingham unsuccessfully, and the Vice Chancellor John Latham at Coventry, I asked him if he would be a referee for me for a particular role. I said, yeah, of course I will. Why don't you come and work at the university? Nothing about universities. I did my degree by correspondence while I was in New Zealand. So what on earth could I do there? And he said, oh, you know, we've got stuff that you could do. And it was certainly part of what I do is part of what John used to do before he became Vice Chancellor. So I had to think about it and talk to the family and everything. And suddenly, okay, let's have a go at that. And, you know, you talk about imposter syndrome. Absolutely, you know, bucket loads of it, but and you know, my colleagues were wonderful and helped me and told me how it all works and what goes on. I'm still learning every day because universities are complex things, but it was just really about you know, if I'd have stayed where I was, I would have continued my career in the Foreign Office. Nothing negative about that. I wouldn't have been a bad outcome, but I thought, could I do something else? And turns out I could. So nothing more than that. Curiosity, I guess, just pushing me again to try a different thing.
Hi, I'm Adam Dent from Advent Communications. We're part of the PLMR Group, which is a top 100 media and communications firm. Our office in the Midlands is based in Coventry. We also have one in Birmingham. We handle all sorts of PR, communications, social media, new media, website design, podcasts, videos. We've worked for the Chamber for 2 decades now, making sure that it's the premier voice in business across Coventry and Warwickshire. We're also members and get absolute full value from our membership. We've met a lot of clients through there, we've got a lot of networking, a lot of influencing. Really, we find it's the number one organisation to be a member of, and we're proud to work for so many of their members.
So after your role in the, well, during your role in the Foreign Office, and you got posted to the West Midlands, and what was your perceptions of the West Midlands, and did you ever think that you'd end up working for, like, in the central Coventry?
So I didn't know much about the West Midlands, but so my job in Australia had been linked to UKTI, so I'd had some experience of the UK regions, and I think it's fair to say that they're not all the same, and I think the West Midlands was, I saw the West Midlands as a particularly relatively strong area, not southeast, but it is a place that is nicely, it works together. And I certainly in Australia did quite a lot of work with the West Midlands. So I was keen. I actually had a choice to go to different parts of the UK. So I chose the West Midlands. I also thought there was a real opportunity for growth. And we did grow significantly. When I got here, I found that there was a massive diversity of companies and people. I wasn't local, didn't know anything, but people were so open and friendly. I had no negative experiences in that in that job. Everyone was happy to explain what they were doing, and I went from the most important, you know, Jaguar Land Rover, the most high-tech companies in the region, to metal bashers, and understanding their businesses and how they were operating, and I found it fascinating and interesting, and understanding how their businesses work. So I was really welcomed in. I didn't expect that this would become my home and where I would live, but I don't regret it at all. And also, you sort of, I think we're a bit shy about being, you know, we're not upfront about this is a great place to be and a great place to live and look how great we are. A bit more modest than that in the West Midlands. But certainly as you embed and get to live here, you find great people, great places, little pockets of beauty and all that sort of stuff. And interestingly, Coventry was a place that I guess my external view of it, didn't feel very welcoming. And I think that's something to do with the Ring Road. But actually, when you're here,
risking your life,
you've been in the Congo.
Yeah, exactly. When you're here, you see this sort of some beautiful parts of it. When the sun's shining, Coventry can be absolutely breathtaking. And often I walk into work through the cathedral, and if the sun's in the right place, it can absolutely take my breath away.
Tells you something how much of a draw Coventry University must have to bring somebody that's had such a fascinating career and bring them here to the heart of Coventry. So what was that role that you accepted then?
So as Pro Vice Chancellor for Enterprise and Innovation, and it's about generating innovation, enterprise in the university, about working with businesses and the NHS and organisations, about getting the knowledge out. If you think of a university as a big pool of knowledge with, you know, 4,500, 5,000 academics, 40,000 students, all of that knowledge, how do we get it out of the university into society? Our students do it every day. We send them off and they enrich society. But how do we get that knowledge out to support businesses and to support the NHS and to support community groups? And my job is about getting that knowledge out. And we do it in a number of ways. But you know, my job is often about translating between the needs of businesses and what academics have to offer, because they often speak different languages. And so my job and my team's job is about making those links work so that we can get that knowledge out to help society. And Coventry is a wonderful place. It's a wonderful university that's always looking to push and innovate and make an impact on its community. Our mission is about creating better futures, and this is the only organisation. So having worked in the civil service with plans and missions and strategic plans and visions and all that sort of stuff, it never really resonated right the way through the organisation. In Coventry, there is nothing we can't do that can't be directly related to that creating better futures, whether it's for our students, our communities, our businesses, etc. That's what we do. And it's wonderful to work in an organisation that has such a clear mission, that has some clear plans to do that. And part of that plan, something we talk about, the Coventry way. And it's an ill-defined phrase and can mean lots of different things. But what it means to me is about innovating and creating and pushing and not accepting second best and realising the talent that we have. Our students are wonderful. Every experience I have with our students is a joy. And we do have problems at times, but they are fundamentally there to learn and to challenge and to drive things forward, and that's inspiring for me as much as anything. And then you look at what we do with business and with government and the NHS. We talked about COVID. Our nursing students, absolutely on the front line, absolutely right there where people were very poorly dying, very difficult, in a very dangerous place for them, and they were there, never, you know, not a question. They went out and did it, and you know, we're very proud of our student body, but also our staff as well, who are incredible, and you know, our research is applied. It's about making a difference. It's challenge led. It's about what needs to be changed to make our society, make business, whatever, better. So it's applied to real life challenges that are out in the world, and we work with people and for people. It's not just something that's we do for the sake of doing research, and that's very much the Coventry way of doing things. So yeah, it's a real pleasure to be part of that institution, and I think the city, I know the city is very proud of what it achieves and the impact that it has, and I think the people inside it are very proud of the students that we get and the impact that our research has and that our interactions with wider society have. So yeah, it's a very enjoyable place to be.
Yeah, I think your pathway, even your pathway into the university, kind of embodies everything it stands for, in that you said kind of you had no experience in the university, but your experience in industry and everything that could bring, and that's the Coventry way in terms of thinking about things differently. I think that's
very insightful. I don't think there's any other university in the country that would have employed me on that basis. I think Coventry is the place that would take a risk, I guess, like that. I didn't have a PhD, I wasn't an academic, I'd never worked in a university, you know, I'd never actually studied in a university, you know, physically, and they took that chance, and that is very much the Coventry way, and I think it's one of the things that makes that institution, our institution, stand out as an institution that's prepared to take a chance, has looking for new ideas, looking to drive forward. All the time, and you're absolutely right. I wouldn't be working in any other university because they wouldn't have had me.
You spoke there about businesses and academics speaking that same language. How do you and your team go about making that happen? Because you are right, they do speak different languages.
Yeah, I think it's so we talk to a lot of businesses, and that's one of the really important things about being members of the Chamber. Is getting out and talking to them and finding out what they need. And I think what we try and do through a series of, I guess we call them products, but capabilities, if you like, try and match them to match what we can do in terms of supporting that business to the needs of the business. And that is about articulating the offer, the support that's available in terms that are relevant to that particular business. So we get to know them. These are generally not transactional things. You know, we just don't have products that we flog to a business. It's usually much more strategic than that. We sit down with them. We try and understand what their challenges are. And often there are lots that we can do. You know, their challenges might be around skills or staff. The challenges might be around a new product development or some bit of technology, etc., or understanding policy. All of those things we can help with, but they're not it's not a retail offer. It's about getting to know them and understanding them, and then we work with them to design a program that's right for that business in whatever form. I absolutely, with one of our very largest regional companies, had a meeting with them yesterday about how we co-design to meet a big challenge that they have as a business. And while we've got a whole load of things that we can offer, actually what they end up getting will be very different to what we've got to offer. We'll work with them to make it work for them, working with their products so that their staff have the skills they need to be able to move that business forward. And that's very much our model. So it's a bit consultative, so it takes a bit of time. I think we're still not great at being open enough for businesses to interact with us, and we're working to try and make that better. But it's about understanding the business and then trying to translate the activity of what the university does to what the business does.
So to any business listening to this right now that wants to work more closely with the university, what would be your advice to them?
Get in touch with us, and you can do that through the Chamber, or you can get in touch with me directly, and we'll find the right people to come and talk to you about what your needs might be. But it will have to be a discussion first, I think, to really understand how we might help you. We can do loads of stuff, but you probably don't need loads of stuff. You might need some early things, and then we can build onto that. And there is some support out there to help. But yeah, just get in touch with us, and we'd love to have a conversation with you. We help thousands of businesses a year, 14,000 businesses a year. We work with 14,000 businesses a year in this region.
Paul, so on this podcast, we do a quick fire question round right at the end, just to get to know you that little bit more. And I've got to say, it's been fascinating so far. So I'm really looking forward to getting to know you a little bit more. But when we were talking earlier, you mentioned about going hiking down to Birmingham to watch Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
So out of all the concerts you've been to, what's been the best concert you've been to and what's been the worst?
Wow. So the best concert I've been to was a couple of years ago. I went with my son to see Billy Bragg in Manchester, and I've seen Billy Bragg many times, and some of them are a bit better than others. This one was just felt like a big party, and everyone was singing along, and I think my son had bought me the tickets to go, and he's not a great fan, and I think he was just doing something that he thought I would enjoy. We came out of the concert and said, God, Dad, that was great. So yeah, that was one of the best concerts I've ever been to. Worst? So that's a bit more difficult, isn't it? So actually, probably one that happened quite recently and in Coventry. So I've been a big Jethro Tull fan for all my life. And I guess the concert was actually fine and nice, but it wasn't what I was expecting. So I think that's what. So I went to see Jethro Tull in the Cathedral, and I was expecting rock and roll, and I got sort of carols and things. And so it was wonderful to see Ian Anderson playing the flute, and we did get a bit of Jethro Tull in there, but it wasn't quite what I was expecting. So I think it was just it was actually a very enjoyable evening, but it just wasn't quite what I was up for when I left the house.
You don't have to explain yourself. So I guess you've mentioned the different countries you've been in during your time. Which is your favourite?
So the only place I would go and live again, that I would go, you know, if I decided to leave the UK and go and live, would be New Zealand. It's the most wonderful country, great people. Maybe a bit sleepy for me, I guess, but I had such a great time there. It's so nice, and I've been able to go back, and I was there, and I was able to help during the earthquake, Christchurch earthquake. I was in Australia, and I got sent over to help with the response. I've got many friends there. So New Zealand would be the place I would go back to. It's also got a similar climate to the UK, which is, you know, fine.
If you could master one skill, what would that skill be?
Oh, gosh. So I've talked about dancing, haven't I? I would love to be really good at dancing the bachata. And I'm getting there, but when I see my teachers do it, it looks so effortless, and I'm not quite there yet. I've been playing the guitar since I was 18, and you know, I haven't mastered that. So I think something like that, something creative, which is challenging. I guess, so I speak a few languages,
Wow. But
not very well. I'm not very good at any of them.
How many languages?
I speak French and German and Arabic, but none of them very well. So maybe one of those. Maybe, maybe a language, maybe French or something like that, and be comfortable with it. I worked in French when I was in the Congo, but I still don't feel like I do it justice. And this sort of slight Yorkshire accent doesn't help.
And who has been your greatest mentor in your journey?
Oh my gosh, I've had so many, honestly. I think every role that I've talked about, I think I can pick out a mentor that has helped me. And sometimes they've been a sort of peer, sometimes they've been senior, sometimes they've been more junior. But people that have given me something I've taken away. But I think if I was having to choose, I'd say it's a person called Jerry Reffo. So she was my manager in a Foreign Office role we haven't talked about. I was in personnel, she was that person who she pushed through merit-based promotions in the Foreign Office. She had a grit about her to just keep banging her head against the wall till we got the right outcome, and it was a real fight for her, and I saw her fight to change a culture in the Foreign Office, and she certainly inspired me, and she gave me she did a lot around that sort of self-confidence to go and try new things. I could pick one at least from every role that I've had and every place I've been, but Jerry's probably the person that made the biggest impact on me.
Paul, you've had an extremely, extremely successful career. If you had the ability to go back and talk to your younger self, what one piece of advice would you give him?
I think I would tell him to go to university, to not leave school a bit early and go off and work. I think I missed out on an experience that would have been fun. But I would also say, you know, keep being curious and keep trying new things and just have that self-confidence. And even when it goes wrong, and it does, I made loads of mistakes, honestly, I did. Even when it goes wrong, it's never really as bad as you think, and there's always people there. If you're a nice person and you support other people, they've got your back and they'll help you out, and it gives you a confidence that people have got your back. So be nice, keep being curious, and go to university and enjoy it. I think that's the big message I would give to. And my kids both went to university and enjoyed it, and maybe that was me vicariously giving advice to my younger self.
Paul, this session has truly, and I'm not just saying, it's truly been fascinating. I've really enjoyed it. And we're all going to say goodbye in a second, but I wondered, you may want to say it in a different language. You may want to show it off, but that is fully your call. But from me, thank you for joining us, Paul. Thank you for being on this podcast.
Yeah, it's been really enjoyable. And
that's in English, Paul. I can understand that.
So I'm not going to try a different language. I won't. It's been fun. It's interesting because I think when you talk about these things, you know, you often don't have these conversations about your life and what you've done and why you've done it. And it's really useful to have some questions that provoke some of those things. So it's nice reflecting back thinking about where you are and what you've done. It certainly reminds you of some things that may have been sort of pushed to the back of your mind. So thank you very much, both of you.
Nicole, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure having a business talent member here with us, going over, talking about all things talent and skills, especially with somebody who is a leader in the university and education sector. So thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for listening to the Chamber Talks Business Podcast, where we get to speak to some of our region's greatest business leaders and find out what makes them tick. If you'd like to ask a question, then please do submit that to your account manager here
at your Coventry and Warwickshire Chamber of Commerce. If you enjoyed the podcast, then please do subscribe. And if you could leave us a rating and review, it would be great because it would help other people to find us. We very much hope that you are enjoying listening to this podcast series. And any thoughts or queries, then please do pass them through to your representative at the Coventry and Warwickshire Chamber of Commerce. Thank you, and I look forward to speaking to you next time.